I'd like to ask Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli to join us and to introduce our speaker. The Attorney General is Virginia's 46th Attorney General, formerly a state senator from Fairfax. And one fact you may not know about him is that his undergraduate degree from UVA is in mechanical engineering, a rare talent for a lawyer. He and his wife, Tiro, have 7 children, and 5 of those are daughters. And as the mother of 2 daughters, that's a lot of girls.
And I notice that every day. Well, I, of course, need to be forgiven for many things. Some of you may have different lists than I do. But being from Northern Virginia is not one of them. And I am proud to come before you to introduce another Northern Virginian who I first encountered by reputation 36 years ago when my Aunt Bobby brought home a box of envelopes and sheets of paper to stuff those envelopes in his first election. It was the first race I ever worked on. I was 7 years old. And he lost. But don't worry, he tried again in 1978, he lost again. Being perseverant, however, in 1980, he won and is now the dean of Virginia's congressional delegation, Congressman Frank Wolf. And he has earned, through many years, the nickname, if you will, the conscience of the Congress. He is respected, strongly respected, on a bipartisan basis. Not something easy to achieve itself, for his work for the protection of religious liberty and human rights around the world. And America's leadership in protecting human rights and expanding religious liberty around the world. Whether it be sneaking into Tibet, not using his congressional passport so the Chinese didn't know he was there, or protecting the Christians in southern Sudan, numerous visits to that rather desolate part of the world and tormented part of the world. And for those of you in the legislature before this year, may remember the Sudan divestment bill that was begun with conversations with Congressman Frank Wolf, and he has written on these subjects recently in a book you can get on Amazon, soon to be fulfilled here, I assume, called Prisoner of Conscience. It is my great pleasure and honor to introduce to you the Dean of the Virginia Congressional Delegation, Congressman Frank Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken, for the introduction, and I want to thank Bill Mims and Susan and the organizers for the invitation, and thank all of you for being here today. Someone once said that if you got all the speakers in the world and laid them end to end, you ought to just leave them that way. And I hope you won't feel that way when I'm finished. On the day my wife, Carolyn, my wife of 50 years, and I visited Independence Hall with one of our grandsons, our guide shared a story I will never forget. And it is a story that has particular relevance today. She told us that in September of 1787, on the final day of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, 81-year-old Benjamin Franklin is said to have wept. He was crying as he signed the Constitution. James Madison, a great Virginian, in a letter to another great Virginian, Thomas Jefferson, described the scene at the historic gathering as following. Madison wrote, "While the last members were signing it, Dr. Franklin motions toward the president's chair. George Washington was the president of that convention. And at the back of which was a rising sun happened to be painted on the back of the chair. And if you go to Independence Hall, you can still see the chair. And he observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising from a setting sun. Very difficult to see, are you painting a rising or a setting sun? And then Franklin commented that during the course of the session that he had, quote, often looked at the painting behind the president, Washington's chair, without being able to tell whether it was a rising or a setting sun. Franklin concluded as he wept, he said, now at length I have the happiness to know that it is indeed a rising sun and not a setting sun. And history proved Franklin right. He was witnessing the dawn of a new great nation. It seems that every politician since has relished giving speeches in which they say that the sun has barely begun to rise on our country and that America's best days are yet ahead. As much as I long yearn for that to be true, I can't help but wonder if America's best days are yet behind us. And I don't think I'm alone. There's a palpable national anxiety born to certain realities which contribute to this sense of foreboding, exploding debts and deficits, shuttered factories, an acrimonious tenor to our national discourse, the debate on the payroll, Social Security tax in Washington for the last 2 months was painful to watch, and a feeling that we have lost our moral and spiritual bearing as a country. People fear, and I personally fear, that these stark domestic realities have broader implications, that America's influence is waning globally, and that our shining city on a hill, the last best hope for mankind, could be dimming. I personally have never been more concerned for our country's future. We're $15 trillion in debt, and our biggest bankers are China, the government of China, and Saudi Arabia. And the projections are that by the end of this year, before the next prayer breakfast, the debt will be at $17.1 trillion. No nation can really withstand that. Do we really want to be beholden to these governments? And they are our bankers. And this should trouble us. America's fiscal crisis has implications today, but it really has a direct bearing on future generations of Americans, on our children and on our grandchildren. At his 1796 farewell address, our greatest president, George Washington, admonished his fellow countrymen, quote, we should avoid ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden which we ourselves ought to bear, an appropriate charge to those in political leadership in both political parties today. Neil Ferguson, the noted historian, British historian who teaches at Stanford and Harvard, also said, quote, while most historians see the collapse of empires in cyclical and gradual terms, the reality is they tend to collapse rapidly. He goes on to say, great powers and empires are complex systems made up of a very large number of interacting components that are asymmetrically organized, which means that construction more resembles a termite hill than it does an Egyptian pyramid. He says such systems can appear to operate quite stably for a period of time, but there comes a moment when complex systems go critical and they collapse. A very small trigger, he said, can set up a phase transition from a benign equilibrium to a crisis. A single grain of sand then causes the whole pile to collapse. Ferguson points to the empires of ancient Rome and the Ming Dynasty and to the former Soviet Union, all of which collapsed rapidly. In 1986, no one thought the Soviet Union would collapse, and it collapsed rapidly. Oftentimes, their collapse was preceded by out-of-control debt, almost always, And almost always, cases of moral decay. Consider the words of Norm Augustine, the former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin, who since retiring has devoted a great deal of time in trying to get business leaders and others to focus on the critical issues at hand for our country. Norm Augustine said, quote, "Americans have come, and we have all come, to accept leadership as a natural, enduring state of affairs. We just assume we're always going to be number one." But he said, leadership is highly perishable. It must be constantly re-earned. In the 16th century, he said, the citizens of Spain no doubt thought they would remain the world leader. In the 17th century, it was France. We relied on France at Yorktown, General Washington did. In the 19th century, Great Britain. And he said, in the 20th century, it was the United States. And then he ends and goes on to say a very troubling comment. He says, unless we do things dramatically different, the 21st century will belong to China and India. With these historic realities as our backdrops, we have to wonder whether we're headed down a similar path. A sobering thought, to be sure, and one that no one wants to deal with, but if our nation's leaders aren't asking these questions, who will? So today, as we begin a new year and a new opening of the General Assembly and soon to be a new opening in the Congress, with so much at stake for our nation, I want to focus on what kind of leaders we should strive to be and humbly exhort us to pray that we might lead with excellence during these perilous times, with a profound hope that the sun will continue to rise on our land. I want, as a father and a grandfather, I want the sun to rise and not to set. We should aim first and foremost to be men and women of character. We could begin by examining our own hearts and asking ourselves the questions, what kind of person do I want to be? What kind of leader do I want to be? Author Stephen Covey, who has written a number of self-help books, has observed that in the first 150 years of our country, character, honesty, integrity, courage were the things we measured a person by. George Washington, that's what we measured Washington and Lincoln, presidents like that by. But he said in the last 50 years, our measure of a person is largely personality traits. Is she a good communicator? Is he a nice guy? If these are our measures, is it any wonder that it often feels to me, and I don't know about to you, that if the giants of industry and government and even religion have left the field, who are the giants today as we look around our country? We would be well served to return to our roots if to expect more of our leaders than charm or even eloquence. The name of Moses is carved on the wall across from the speaker's rostrum in the House of Representatives. When Moses was choosing helpers to lead Israel, his father-in-law Jethro gave him this advice in Exodus chapter 18, verse 21. He said, "Select capable men and women, I would say, from all the people, men and women who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain." Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17 said, "Learn to do right, seek justice." And many of the prayers today talked about justice. "Encourage the oppressed, defend the cause of the fatherless, and plead the case of the widow." And Micah chapter 6, verse 8 says, "And what does the Lord require?" The word is require. It is an optional to act justly, to have mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So I challenge myself publicly to follow these guidelines, and also you, to be a person who fears God, to be trustworthy, to be a person of integrity and one who pursues justice, and to do all these things in a spirit of humility. We must seek to know our own hearts, not kid ourselves, our weaknesses and our imperfections. and be vigilant in guarding against such failings, even as we pursue these worthy goals. I want to continually publicly ask myself, do I want to be a man of excellence or a man of expedience? A man of principle or one who seeks to be popular? I like to be popular. I like to see a good article in the paper. I like to see an editorial thing. But do I want to be a man of principle or do I want to be popular? Do I want to be a man who looks for the right thing to do and does it? Or a man who finds the easy way around whatever I'm facing? One of my favorite plays is the Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons. It is a historical account of one chapter in the life of Sir St. Thomas More. In one of the most convincing scenes, More is asked by the Duke of Norfolk to go along with him and others for the sake of fellowship and publicly agree with King Henry VIII. Many times in politics on the floor, they'll say, hey, let's be together for fellowship. Let's stick together, gang. But More says, and when we stand before God and you are sent to paradise for doing it according to your conscience, and I am damned for not doing it according to mine, will you come with me for fellowship? Sometimes we may find ourselves standing alone on a difficult issue. Such situations will test our character, for in the words of Bobby Kennedy, few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, and the wrath of their society. And Bobby Kennedy goes on to say, moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence, yet it is the one essential vital quality of those who seek to change a world which yields most painfully to change. May we be men and women of courage and character. And secondly, I think particularly in these times, we need to foster reconciliation. Being men and women of reconciliation is difficult but critical in today's environment. At times, the divides between us seem insurmountable. The Congress has never been more polarized since I have served there for over 30 years. So what we need in the country and the world is reconciliation. Reconciliation between the races, religions, countries, spouses, between children and parents, and between neighbors, and yes, between political parties. So today, regardless of religious reviews, consider the teachings of Jesus, who is the greatest authority on reconciliation. Jesus stressed the importance of forgiveness and loving one's enemies over and over and over. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 21 and 22, Peter asked Jesus, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Up to seven times. And Jesus answered, I tell you not seven times, but 70 times seven. And so when I think of reconciliation in the political arena, William Wilberforce comes to mind. Wilberforce brought together a group of British parliamentarians from across the political spectrum, not just from his political party, committed to abolishing the slave trade in England at a time when the country's economy was dependent on this injustice. The elimination of the slave trade is what Wilberforce is most known for. But he and his friends were active in at least 69 different projects: prison reform, education, child labor conditions, and the reformation of culture, including anti-gambling. And when I look around the nation today, gambling is spreading everywhere. And thank goodness not here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. 30 years ago, I joined a small group in U.S. Congress modeled after the Wilberforce group, similar to what Todd was talking about. We meet together weekly in the House Chapel for fellowship, Bible study, accountability, though. We hold each other accountable, and encouragement. Hebrews 10:12-25 tells us, let us not give up meeting together, as some of us are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another. This group has been a source of strength and encouragement for me. When my hands are hanging down and my eyes are burning, the fellowship that this group has provided as a place of refuge and support, some of my biggest decisions have been made there. And in the group, strangely enough, my best friend is a former member of Congress, Tony Hall, a Democrat from Ohio. Tony and I disagree on many issues. It was not uncommon for us to leave the chapel to vote. One would vote yes, and one would vote no. But our relationship transcends party. We've traveled together. Our families are close. Tony has even contributed, if you check the FEC reports, to my political campaign. In fact, Tony was asked to speak with us today by Bill, and Tony is in Jordan as I now speak. Our friendship is a testament to the fact that when people meet together respectfully and begin to listen to each other and work toward reconciliation, it changed the nature on the way they conducted business on the floor of the House and in committee meetings, because if you pray for someone and they pray for you, it is impossible to turn on them and much easier to work together. My relationship with Tony has shaped my time in Congress. Had I not been part of the small group, I would have been a different person in Congress and in my family. When Tony was in Congress, we worked together on issues of human rights, hunger, religious freedom, blood diamonds, and we still work together today. I believe if we can come together in the spirit of civility and reconciliation, finding common cause on issues of shared concerns, we can begin to transform our country. So while most of us in this room or in this business sometimes operate in the political realm, I think it's important to recognize that the problems facing our country are not purely political, or even, I would say, mostly political. Such solutions will not ultimately come from government. That is not to say we in government cannot improve things greatly, because we can, but we do our nation a disservice if we assume that we can solve all of our problems politically. For I would argue there's something greater, far greater, that is ailing our country. Something that is profoundly, profoundly moral in nature. There is an insidious relativism that teaches that concepts of right and wrong are old-fashioned, antiquated, even at times judgmental. Vices are elevated and virtues are mocked. Faith is squeezed out of the public square, and our culture, I believe, is coarsened as a result of it. These seemingly intangible realities have a profound implication. More than 150 years ago, French statesman Alexis de Tocqueville came to these shores seeking to understand the secret of America's greatness. De Tocqueville wrote, and I quote, "I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors and ample rivers," and he said it wasn't there. He said, "in her fertile fields and boundless forests," and he said it was not there. "In her rich mines and her vast world commerce," and again, it was not there. "In her democratic Congress and her matchless constitution," and de Tocqueville said it was not there. "Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness did I understand the secrets of her genius and power." America is great, he said, because she is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. De Tocqueville's observations were in keeping with our founding fathers. Understanding what would be necessary for the experiment in self-governance to flourish, they believed in the triangle of first principles. Freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires religious faith. And faith requires freedom. George Washington knew that religion, I would say faith, and morality are the most important sources of character and are necessary, I would say necessary, for the maintenance of public justice, order, and prosperity. As such, in our political activity, we should focus on creating a national climate where conscience is cultivated and character flourishes. It is to that end that public policy, political, and social must be directed. Is our nation close to a tipping point? or a turning point. Many times people don't really want to hear the truth. I get people say, Wolf, well, you know, that, it reminds me of that song sung by Simon and Garfunkel in Central Park called The Boxer. Man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Conservative Washington columnist Charles Krauthammer recently wrote, for America today, decline is not a condition. Decline is a choice. Two threads, he said, into this unipolar world that come about when we look at the fall of the Soviet Union. He said, America is in a position of deciding. We get to decide whether to abdicate or to retain its dominance. He goes on to say, decline or ascendancy, the rising or the setting sun, is in our hands. You and I, we the people, get to determine whether the sun is rising or setting in America. Indeed, there is much in our hands. We can be men and women of integrity and character. We can make decisions, even if it means standing alone. We can lead with humility and seek to foster reconciliation. We can acknowledge the moral dimension of our problems and the fight to make America good so that she may remain great. And perhaps most importantly, and you're here at this prayer breakfast, we can pray. You've come to this prayer breakfast, presumably, because you'll believe in the power of prayer. I'm reminded of experience I had several years ago. I was at a restaurant, the Marco Polo restaurant in my district in Vienna, where an elderly woman asked for me, with an Eastern European accent, asked me why I thought the Soviet Union had collapsed. I gave a very reliable Republican answer. I talked about Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Pope John Paul II, all of whom came on the world scene at the same time. I talked about the arms race. I lauded Ronald Reagan for the evil empire speech he gave in Orlando in 1983. And I went on and on and on. She let me finish. And then she told me that she believed that Russia had collapsed because of people of faith the world over, including those suffering behind the Iron Curtain, had been praying for the fall of the Soviet Union for decades. I was struck by her answer and reminded anew, as a young kid, my mom and dad taught me to pray for the collapse of the Soviet Union ever since I was a child. Likely not an explanation that would resonate at the State Department or the Department of Defense or the National Security Council, but I believe it is true. So in that spirit, believing that God answers prayers, we've gathered today in 1 Timothy 2:2, we are urged to pray, quote, for all those in authority, that we may live peaceable and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. Indeed, we should be praying for those in authority in every area of life, government, business, religious institutions, the military, the family, education, media, and the culture. In John 12:42-43, John says, many of the leaders of the time, quote, loved the praise from men more than the praise from God. They were concerned with their popularity. I'm concerned with my popularity. What about all of us? Each of us needs to examine our own heart. We must lift up our leaders and pray for them to have the wisdom and the courage to make sound decisions that are good for the future of the Commonwealth and our country, our world, and even to do so when it is difficult and unpopular at the time. So we return to the original question. Is the sun still rising over America, or is it about to set? I believe if we are indifferent to the signs of economic and moral collapse, then Neil Ferguson's prediction will come true. America will rapidly decline, and then we and everyone else will live in a more dangerous world. In returning to his farewell address, George Washington said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. The general was right. Will we remember and act on his warnings? If we do, then America's best days will still yet be ahead, and the sun will barely have begun to rise on our country. And finally, we should pray that God's favor would rest on this land and that a new dawn would break and that America's best days would be a legacy for our children and our grandchildren. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Congressman Wolf. A sobering message that we will all be thinking about over and over again. Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling will join us now to pray for Virginia's executive officials and will introduce the governor. And beginning at noon today, he will be presiding over an evenly divided Senate, and I'm sure would covet our prayers for the wisdom of Solomon and the patience of Job.
Thank you. Thank you. And the courage of David, I might add, in the process. Good morning. It is good to be here. Congressman, thank you for your words. Those were words that I think are both inspirational and they will make us think. And we appreciate very much your being here today to do that. Well, look, I want to start by having a word of prayer for the those who serve in the executive branch of our state government. And I would ask that you join me in that word of prayer. Dear Father, you tell us in your word to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. So this morning, we have responded to that call. We have gathered together in this place men and women of many different backgrounds, many different faith traditions, many different walks of life. Yet when we come together in this place, we become one through the common belief that we have in you, and the common commitment that we have in doing our best day by day to do that thing that the Apostle Paul told us to do, to live a life that becomes the gospel and to walk worthy of the vocation to which we're called. You also tell us in your word that we should cease not to pray without ceasing. We believe that there is a God in heaven. We believe that you hear and answer prayer. So today we've come in this place to pray. We've prayed for those who serve in Virginia's armed forces and our public safety personnel. We've prayed for Virginia's judges and those who are involved in the administration of justice. We've prayed for our legislators. We've prayed for our youth and our families. We've prayed for the least among us. And now, Father, we pause to pray for those who serve in the executive branch of our state government. Lord, I ask that you bless our governor. I ask that you bless our attorney general. And I ask, Father, that you continue to bless and guide my steps. I ask that you bless and guide all those who serve in the cabinet of the governor, those who serve as agency heads and department heads, and those who work day by day within the various departments and agencies of the executive branch of our state government. So much in life does depend upon leadership, upon the leader in whom we put our trust, spiritually speaking, but also upon the quality of leadership that we have day by day, whether it's in our government or it's in our businesses or it's in our home. And Father, we do indeed pray that you would give all those who serve in this way that courage of David, that wisdom of Solomon, that patience of Job, that in all of our decisions we might be guided by the single goal of doing what is good and just and right and what will ultimately help us build a better Virginia. And lead us day by day in our actions, in the way that we live our lives, that those around us might see that faith that we have kindled within our own lives and that they might, through our example, want that fire of faith kindled in their life as well. And we will never fail in giving you the praise and in giving you the thanks for all that we accomplish. For it is in your blessed and holy name we ask it, and all God's people say, amen. Well, I get a twofer today. I get to pray and then I get to introduce the governor for his response. I don't know how long I've been coming to these Commonwealth prayer breakfasts. It's been a while. And I've always been intrigued by this concept of a response, because in some way it implies that the the responder, in this case, of course, the governor, is in somehow going to dissect and tear apart the comments that we've just heard from our speaker. And that, of course, is not the intent of the response. I have been able to introduce Governor McDonald, as you might imagine, many times over the years. I have many introductions that I give of him, a serious introduction. I have a humorous introduction. We've learned to play pretty well off of each other over the years. Sometimes we just poke back and forth at each other in introductions. But most of the things that I could say about him, you already know. The one thing that I thought I would tell you in just briefly introducing to you a person who really needs no introduction that you may not see day by day, is that our governor is a man of great faith. His faith is a very important part of his life. I can tell you that it guides his conduct, not just in public service, but also in his family. There have been many occasions that we have had the opportunity to pause and pray in his office, in the cabinet room, in the governor's mansion, as we're traveling around the state attending events. And there will be times, politically speaking, in the life of any governor or leader, that we will agree or disagree on policies or on decisions. But if we know the heart of the people who lead us, it gives us a confidence that they will do their best day by day to lead us in the right way. So of all the things I could say in introducing you this morning, the 71st governor, is that right? 71st? 71st governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, the one that I think is most appropriate to this occasion is he is not just our leader, but he is also a man of great personal faith. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege to present to you the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Bob McDonald.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, and good morning, all. Lieutenant Governor, appreciate your very warm introduction, your leadership, and your own faithfulness to the people of Virginia. Congressman Wolf, as always, a stimulating and thoughtful presentation. It's actually great to see all the congressmen here because it means you're not in session, which is either Twain or Jefferson, I think, says that the liberty and the prosperity of the people is never safe while the Congress or the General Assembly is in session. And so, at least for the General Assembly, that ends today. And they will be back. And for all of you, whether you're returning or newly to be sworn in, I salute you and thank you for your faithfulness and your willingness to serve the people of Virginia. My remarks will be short, unlike tonight. So you can prepare for the longer version as you rejoin tonight at 7 in the Capitol. But I want to say this is always a fantastic day for our state. We always start the first day of the General Assembly in prayer with 1,000 people coming together of various faiths to reflect upon that important part of who we are as a people in America. You get sworn in at noon. I get sworn at 12:05. Seems to happen every year. And then tonight, all branches of government come together for that one special night a year where we talk about the state of the Commonwealth. I'm reminded that this was a nation essentially born on its knees 405 years ago as a cross was planted at Cape Henry in Virginia Beach, and those 144 men and boys that had taken 144 days to come across the seas paused to give thanks to God and claim that this was going to be a different kind of nation born in faith and freedom. It was cemented on its knees with Washington kneeling at Valley Forge in the darkest days of the American Revolution. And so I believe, as Congressman Wolf has said, it's been the faith of the people that has made us an exceptionally great nation. With all our faults and our warts, the reason we have long endured is because of the faith of the American people. There's a couple things I got listening to the scriptures and the congressmen and others speak today. And, you know, we all have a very short time in which to serve, those of us that have the privilege of serving in elected office. I have 4 years. For many of you, that may not be short enough. But that's the time that the Constitution has given me to have this high honor of following in Jefferson and Henry's footsteps. The concept of public service is one that I think bears reminding from time to time in what it really meant. Jesus, in discussing with his disciples this concept of service and greatness, and they were battling for who was going to be the greatest of those 12 in that first small group, congressman, he shut them down as he looked them in the eyes, and he said, "The greatest among you is the servant of all." And in fact, he said that he, the Son of Man, the King of Glory, the only Son of God, came not to be served, but to serve. If that's the model that Jesus set, then certainly all of us with the privilege of being in elected office, with all the perks and the headlines and so forth that we get from time to time, should always remember that we are great through our service to others. Secondly, I find myself, and from the scriptures today, I find myself praying more and more, not for the things I did when I was younger, but I pray for wisdom. Because in these jobs, I think more than anything else, that's what we need. In fact, the Proverbs are very clear that more to be desired and treasured than silver or gold is wisdom. How to split the baby, how to make the tough decisions, the hundreds of votes that we will cast over these next 60 days will require great wisdom. The fourth chapter of Proverbs says to seek wisdom to gain understanding, though it cost all you have to gain wisdom. Third is that in all that we do, we must exercise that gift of humility. The congressman talked about that in his remarks. Jesus, as he was talking to the disciples, giving his Sermon on the Mount, said that blessed are the meek and the humble of heart. I was very impressed a few weeks ago. We had Jim Collins here to speak to all of our cabinet and all of our members of the executive team, our agency leaders. And he wrote a book called Good to Great. Many of you probably have read it. And he's studied for years and years the traits of leaders in America and what distinguished those who led great corporations and those that didn't. And after all the research, he concluded with this very simple thought. He said, the X factor in leadership is humility. Those that were ambitious for the organization and for the greater good and not for themselves were the greatest leaders. I thought that was something that ratified what we know intuitively, but yet has been proven out by experience. And finally, as the congressman talked about the importance of the moral fabric of the nation, I know how important it is to have a vision for the future. The scriptures say that for lack of vision, the people perish. But I believe the opposite is also true. With vision, the people will flourish. Congressman, I believe also that Washington was our greatest president. I remember yet a different quote, one that he gave in his first inaugural address about the importance of character and moral values for this nation. He said, the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected to remain on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right, which heaven itself has ordained. I think Washington, being a man of faith, spending time on his knees, after all the battles and travails of the Revolution, not having seen Mount Vernon but once in 8 years, understood that for the nation to long endure, that it must be a nation that regards the eternal values of order and right, which heaven itself has ordained. So as we start this session, I hope that will be our guideposts, that we will truly be people that regard service and wisdom and humility and values as our hallmarks as we go forward. God bless you.
Thank you, Governor McDonald. Before we have our closing, I'd like to go over a few housekeeping details, a couple of details. I'd like to say a very special thank you.